Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Jim, we start with the good, although the overarching story could end up being fairly bad. Yesterday, Bernie Sanders went to the White House. Less than 48 hours earlier, he had vowed to fight on to the convention for every last superdelegate vote. About 5 seconds after he left the White House, the president formally endorsed Hillary Clinton, and Elizabeth Warren did it later in the day. So it looks like Barack Obama pretty much convinced Bernie Sanders to pack it in sooner rather than later, although we'll see exactly when that happens. One of the big questions, of course, now that Obama has formally endorsed Hillary Clinton, is whether this means there's any possibility of the FBI recommending or the Justice Department actually pursuing any sort of criminal charges against Clinton for her handling of secure information, for the private server, and all sorts of other potential charges that many legal experts have talked about. James Rosen of Fox News brought up the issue at the White House briefing with Josh Earnest yesterday, and Josh Earnest used a phrase that I'm pretty sure Obama and Hillary Clinton would have preferred he left out.
You don't think that that career prosecutor or that FBI agent takes that as some indication of how the president wants to see this case resolved?
Those career prosecutors understand that they have a job to do, and that job that they are supposed to do, which is to follow the facts, to pursue the evidence to a logical conclusion, that is a job that they are responsible for doing without any sort of political interference. And the president expects them to do that job. The president, when discussing this issue in each stage, has reiterated his commitment to this principle that any criminal investigation should be conducted independent of any sort of political interference.
Criminal investigation, Jim. I thought this was just a security review.
A security inquiry. It's not. Yeah, it's an inquiry. Like, hey, could you pass the salt? That's an inquiry about whether you're capable of passing the salt. So, a rather awkward admission there. I'm kind of left fascinated by just what the options are before the FBI, because it's really hard to believe they're going to, you know, after what we've seen from the State Department Inspector General looking at a much more narrow issue, come away with a pretty scathing report, that for them to say, yeah, never mind, everything's fine, you know, no harm, no foul, we're all good. If they do, a lot of people will be, you know, saying, okay, somebody got to the FBI. In all likelihood, the FBI is going to continue this criminal investigation and conclude that a crime has been committed, because it certainly looks like that was the case. Front page of the Wall Street Journal, headline, Clinton emails dealt with drones. I don't know about you, Greg. I figured stuff about drone killings. That sounds the sort of thing that would be classified to me.
Yes.
Imagine the sort of thing. You wouldn't just be like, hey, we're droning Ali Oxenfree next week. You're up for it? You're going to watch that? You know, it's not the sort of thing you can just casually email about folks. Then the question then will be, what does the Justice Department do? And if, as many people, you know, suspect with cynicism and you know, a decent amount of historical experience, the Justice Department says, nah, then the question is, what does James Comey and the rest of the FBI do? And there have been persistent rumors that they resign, which could be worse for Hillary, because then you can't really appeal an FBI director's resignation. And the question is, does Comey do this very publicly, or does he just do it quietly with an angry letter or something like that? There's no way this issue goes away, and the entire Democratic Party is just kind of walking around in denial, kind of hoping and thinking that it's just not going to be this story will go away, everybody will forget about it, or even if people have really deep concerns about it and they don't trust Hillary Clinton, they'll like the other option worse. And that just seems like a really big gamble in this kind of political mood.
It certainly is. And the Washington Examiner makes the story even worse today by saying that investigators seem to be poring over, in particular, 47 different emails that could potentially have compromised CIA missions and or personnel. And I have a hard time thinking, regardless of the political climate, that the FBI will be very interested in just glossing over that. There was news that Loretta Lynch met with the president after the endorsement yesterday, so everybody's assuming that that was his marching orders not to prosecute. Pretty sure he could have done that without meeting with her in person, but who knows. On to the bad martini now. And Jim, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is pretty much synonymous with the bad martini. We don't get a lot of good martinis out of the Ninth Circuit, but this one yesterday has got a lot of folks very upset. This is the NBC News story. A divided federal appeals court in California ruled Thursday that there is no constitutional right to carry a concealed handgun, adding to a division among the lower courts on gun rights outside the home. By a vote of 7-4, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco upheld a California law that requires gun owners to show a good reason before they can get a license to carry a concealed handgun. In part, the statement, the majority opinion from the court read, "The protection of the Second Amendment, whatever the scope of that protection may be, simply does not extend to the carrying of concealed firearms in public by members of the general public," unquote. And they go on to fully defend, as we just mentioned, requiring people to have a good reason to have a gun, and safety alone is not good enough, apparently, in some of these jurisdictions. So, Jim, not understanding the scope of the protection, which seems to be shall not be infringed, could make a lot more gun-free zones here real soon.
Yeah, you feel like you win some days with things like the Heller decision, and then it feels like the judges take it away the next day. I'd really look at this thing. Wait a minute. I thought the Heller decision proved once and for all the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to a firearm, and you do not have a right to say no. You don't have that right. We in the city government of District of Columbia decided you don't need one. You don't deserve one. So we've decided that that part of the Constitution doesn't apply to you. Apparently, these judges in the Ninth, never mind. You know, doesn't matter. We're just going to ignore that, and we're going to make this decision because we don't like guns, and we're going to go with this. And I remember making, I discussed this with Cam Edwards on NRA News yesterday. And, one of the things that's fueling the Trump phenomenon, fueling this mood of anger in the country, is you see judicial decisions like this where they just change the law overnight, and something you've been doing as part of your life for decades, they suddenly tell you, oh, no, that's been against the Constitution all along. Now, it's been a part of your life. What I had in mind was there was a judge, I believe it was out in California, who said, including under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, constituted a violation of the separation of church and state. And by golly, every school's got to stop using under God and the Pledge of Allegiance right now. Now, everybody had grown up doing that. This is what makes people, instead of looking at judges with a certain amount of respect, a certain amount of deference and appreciation for their prudence and wisdom, he just looks like this maniac saying, no, I've decided everything you've been doing your entire life is wrong and you have to change because I say so. We could have stuck as part of the British colonies if we wanted to be governed like this. And so the idea that, here's the thing. This is a really bad decision from the Ninth Circuit. Like, well, okay, the Supreme Court will knock that down. Maybe not. We only have 8 justices right now. We all don't know who's going to be replacing Justice Scalia. And so it's a possibility that the Heller decision could, if things don't turn out well for us, could be seen as a very short-lived victory in the fight for Second Amendment rights, and that the Second Amendment may end up being kind of this optional, ornamental amendment in the not-too-distant future.
Well, certainly could be. And by the way, it was the Ninth Circuit that also struck down under God from the pledge. So
there we go. Okay.
They've got a fun history of doing all this sort of thing. So, Jim, you mentioned the Supreme Court. And for a lot of folks, even conservatives who don't love Trump but have decided that they're going to vote for him over Hillary, they say, well, the Supreme Court's at stake in this general notion. Now we have a specific case that could end up before the court with the next president picking the ninth justice, perhaps by the time the case gets heard. Do you think if this case and some other cases get going, that this becomes a much more real issue and that folks are going to reconsider what they do here? How do you think this plays out politically?
The only thing I'd like to say, yeah, this is going to really mobilize gun owners and they're going to recognize that their Second Amendment right. I was having this conversation with some conservative bloggers last night, and we had the observation that something like the lawsuit over Little Sisters of the Poor, you and I believe it's ridiculous for the government to say, hey, you nuns, you absolutely must pay for birth control. That's not the job of the federal government. It's not the role of the federal government. We don't want the administration, butting their nose in there. But for a lot of people, they're not a member of the Little Sisters of the Poor. They may have barely even heard of them. It's not their fight. It's just abstract idea. They're just not going to get that fired up about it. The moment the government gets to, hey, you know that gun you have? You can't have that anymore. We're going to take something from you. We're going to take something that is tangible. Then you think people get really fired up and mobilized. Now, the only thing that has to be a little kind of a cautionary note or maybe a little bit of an asterisk there is that, look, the NRA said it was going to fight like the Dickens in 2008 and in 2012, and they did mobilize a bunch of their voters. But ultimately, they were not able to sway the entire election. And some states where they have a lot of members, like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio, still ended up voting for Barack Obama. So a fired up Second Amendment community is not a guarantee of a Republican victory. Some might say this is attributable to flaws in McCain or flaws in Romney. I think it's much simpler to say, look, there were other big issues on the plate, the country in those, particularly in 2008 with the economic collapse. But look, you know, gun owners, if you're not voting on this and you're not mobilized on this, you know, you just may not be a gun owner for that much longer.
I know Cam would certainly have more data on this issue than I would, and given your expertise on the issue as well. When you look at the major shootings, they're usually in gun-free zones, whether it's theaters or universities, high schools, even grade school, unfortunately, in the case of Sandy Hook. And so if you're not allowed to have a gun outside your own home, that could be anywhere. On to the crazy martini now, and on to Donald Trump. He's had it pretty easy so far in today's Three Martini Lunch. Not much longer. USA Today and Wall Street Journal both, Jim, releasing stories now that he's locked up the nomination on the fact that he's pretty much a deadbeat. This is USA Today. At least 60 lawsuits, along with hundreds of liens, judgments, and other government filings reviewed by the USA Today network, document people who have accused Trump and his businesses of failing to pay them for their work. Among them, a dishwasher in Florida, a glass company in New Jersey, a carpet company, a plumber, painters, 48 waiters, dozens of bartenders and other hourly workers at his resorts and clubs coast to coast, real estate brokers who sold his properties, and ironically, several law firms that once represented him in these same suits and others. Trump's companies have also been cited for 24 violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act since 2005 for failing to pay overtime or minimum wage, according to U.S. Department of Labor data. That includes 21 citations against the defunct Trump Plaza in Atlantic City and 3 against the also out of business Trump Mortgage LLC in New York. So, Jim, I'm sure these are the best invoices, the best collection notices that anybody's ever gotten. But what do you make of the fact that the guy who has is basically running on his business record has got this now?
Throughout the entire messy, ugly, hard fought, you know, Republican primary, Republican rivals of Trump looked at Trump and said, "How do you beat this guy?" Most of these attacks just bounce off him. His base doesn't really care about this. Or they agree with him on issues like immigration, and they just simply aren't going to listen to complaints about his business record and things like that. I remember sitting there thinking that, like, at the core of it, you know, people may or may not believe, like, you could point out that Trump had employed illegal immigrants or had contractors that used contractors that employed illegal immigrants, and people didn't really care. You could point to him indicating he wanted to expand H-1B visas, and people kind of shrug at that. I think at the core of it comes down to Trump says he's for the little guy, but if you are the little guy, Trump will step on you. If you're in his way, you'll do it. And obviously, there was this big argument at whether eminent domain and whether that was important enough. I think, you know, the fact that he's trying to take a little old lady's house in order to build a parking lot, like, that's just, you know, that's sort of central casting of an evil GOP businessman. But in this case, one, there's this wonderful, perfect metaphor of a billionaire deadbeat. Right, the guy who's got tons of money and keeps telling everybody he's got tons of money but doesn't pay his bills. Now, some might say, isn't that kind of a good metaphor for America, Jim? And the debts and the debts that we run up. But basically, this is a perfect indicator that if you don't have enough leverage over Trump, he doesn't feel any need to keep his word. Which, by the way, should make conservatives very nervous, because once he's in the Oval Office, you lose any leverage over him because he's president of the United States and he can just simply ignore you for 4 years if he feels like it. He may end up making conservative decisions. He may not make conservative decisions. I think it's just a bad habit. And this was not obscure. I mean, these stories of Trump stiffing people were pretty common. I've probably repeated my story of Dad negotiating the lease with him back in, you know, 82, 83, and how you just couldn't trust the guy. This has been out there. You know, really suspicious minds, Greg, are going to look at this and say, isn't it fascinating the general election developed such a real deep interest in this story now that he's the Republican nominee and didn't seem to ever get around to this in great detail in 2015. Kind of surprising and very convenient for Hillary Clinton, isn't it, Greg?
Oh, it's shocking. Shocking that it didn't come out until after it was too late for another Republican candidate to take advantage of it. Your point is well taken, though. Would it have done any good? I mean, the Trump supporters, the vast majority of them are so locked in, and they've been locked in from pretty much the get-go on this thing. So I'm not sure this particular story would have
his
done
core
that much
of
more,
supporters
but
are probably locked in. Let's face it, particularly as, you know, in those latter primaries, he was, you know, it's not that 70% of New Yorkers are New York Republicans or Trump people. It's that by that point he had kind of accumulated momentum. And if you had done instead of dropping $20 million in attack ads on Marco Rubio's head, if Jeb Bush had done this, you know, constant thing of, you know, Trump says he's for the little guy, but he steps on the little guy. Trump isn't really on your side. This is a pose. You can't trust him. He's not, you know, and he's telling you what you want to hear. And as soon as he doesn't need you anymore, he's going to drop you like a, you know, like a hot potato. You'd end up with a circumstance where I think it would have done more damage than the approaches that they went to. Jeb basically is doing what Hillary did for a while, which I mean, I'm not even going to dignify that with a response.
Well, you saw how that worked.
Yeah, that didn't work at all. But it does explain his statement, at least at one point, that he said he just wouldn't pay off the debt at certain points.
Yeah, it's a habit. Yeah, and here's the thing. You know, Greg, you and I would be a lot richer if we just never had to pay bills either, huh?
Right. Somehow I don't think we'd get away with it quite as well. But I'll let you try it first.
Sorry, that's creditors on line two.
Jim, have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.